Coming up now on 810, good morning. Well, sex, power, in the workplace is the subject of the next Park City Area Project for Deeper Understanding Forum that'll be held Thursday night at St. Luke's Episcopal Church. The panel will focus on the recent Me Too movement, which has empowered women to speak out against sexual harassment and sexual assault, especially in the workplace. Joining me now on the phone is local attorney Mike O'Brien. He's with Jones Waldo. He spent the last 30 years in employment law. He helps businesses put policies in place to protect workers against harassment. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay. So you've seen a surge in requests for employer and employee training after the Me Too movement made headlines. Are you seeing some panic from business owners who may not have the right policies in place?
Well, you know, there's been a spectrum of reactions, and I think some of it's been a little bit of panic for people who weren't positioned correctly to deal with it. But I think a lot of employers also have viewed this as a teaching moment, you know, an opportunity when their employees are paying attention to the news and seeing work-related issues there, and so they can kind of connect up that teaching moment with what they're seeing in the news to what happens in the workplace.
So how is it that you can help these businesses?
Well, as you mentioned in the kind introduction, I've been working with businesses for 30 years to help them comply with the employment laws. And we've done training for a number of years for those businesses. So what we typically will do is come out and provide a 90 or so minute training program for supervisors, help them understand their role in making sure the company culture is appropriate and respectful and kind to others, and offering practical suggestions on how to deal with problems when they do arise.
Yeah. So, I mean, what are some of the problems that you see?
Well, there's a whole spectrum of issues. I mean, you know, we're all familiar with the sort of Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, Kevin Spacey, you know, actual sexual assault. And that does happen from time to time in the workplace. But, you know, on the other end of the spectrum are just really unthinking comments, stupid jokes, stupid emails that have some sort of a sexual or a racial comment that people often send without thinking. And so we help employers deal with that whole spectrum of inappropriate behavior and make sure that they have a culture that treats people, you know, with respect and doesn't focus on those sorts of things that divide us.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we saw during the election, I mean, there was a whole bunch of that just, oh, that's just locker room talk, and as if it was somehow okay. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, my experience is that there's a lot of people that don't intend to offend, that they say things, you know, the quote-unquote locker room talk, thinking it's funny or thinking that they're bonding with their fellow locker room talkers, but they don't realize in many cases that it really is offensive to a number of other people who might overhear it or, you know, who may be the subject to it. And so I think it's a matter of helping to raise consciousness that, you know, even those, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can also be pretty harmful too.
Yeah. So are there basically some boilerplate policies that companies should have to work with?
Yes. Well, I kind of recommend that companies consider the model for good personal health, which is prevention and treatment. So an organization has to try to prevent harassment by effective training, clear policies, and creating a culture of respect and civility. So, you know, you have to talk the talk, but you also have to walk the walk. So if you do have a health condition arise, in the workplace, if you have an issue arise, you go to a doctor, you get treatment. So if an issue arises in the workplace, you've got to investigate it, you've got to enforce your policies and make sure people understand that there's a consequence for violating them. And you have to make sure that the culture that you're trying to strive to create of civility is maintained. So you have to walk the walk, too.
Yeah. So do policies vary from business to business?
There's, you know, a basic standard that will say, you know, the company prohibits discrimination based on the applicable protected classes, that it prohibits harassment based on those classes, and it also prohibits retaliation for someone who complains. And so there's a number of standard features. But organizations have varied those features from time to time. For example, I know one organization that wanted to focus more on culture. So they included those points, but they also included a number of examples of how people can improve their individual specific company culture. So there's a lot of leeway for companies to work to try to improve this in their own specific circumstances.
So without violating any attorney-client privilege, can you share any examples of how someone could innocently cross the line when it comes to what's appropriate versus not appropriate at the workplace?
Well, you probably saw an article in the Salt Lake Tribune a day or two ago about hugging in the workplace. you know, that's a good example. I mean, we've seen situations where, you know, some individuals are, you know, to use the technical word, right, they're huggers. And other people don't really like to be hugged by people they don't know that well. And I think that's an example where someone can innocently try to express appreciation or affection for a coworker, but actually be inappropriately invading their body space and making them feel uncomfortable. So I think employers need to be aware that in those situations, if an employee is complaining about that problem, then that's something the employer has to deal with, because you know we need to make sure that people don't feel that level of discomfort. But on the other hand, again, a number of those folks are not intending to be sexual predators by trying to hug a coworker.
So many people meet their spouse at work, especially when we spend so much time here. Is it completely forbidden now to be romantically interested in a coworker?
No, it's not completely forbidden, but, you know, it's dangerous too, right? I mean, half of all marriages fail, according to statistics, so the percentage for unmarried consensual relationships must be even higher. And in the aftermath of that failed relationship, we've seen situations turn into ugly lawsuits, because what was welcomed before is no longer welcomed in the aftermath of the breakup and becomes an accusation of sexual harassment.
Hmm. So what should an employee do if they think they've been sexually harassed?
Well, the best thing to do is to contact your human resource director at the company. Most company policies will say contact HR to let them assist you. You can also contact your supervisor or another member of management. So there's usually multiple levels of or multiple channels of complaint in case one or the other is not going to work for that individual situation. And that's the first place to start. And then once that complaint is raised, and once a company knows about a possible problem, it has an obligation under the law to look into it and remedy it. So I think that's the most effective way to deal with the problem.
Yeah, and that's assuming that it's a large business. I mean, we've got lots and lots of small businesses here in Park City, many times probably the owner you know, running the business. In that case, what, you just leave?
No, great question. In that situation, the owner, of course, has to take on the obligation that HR would play in a larger situation, and their policy should reflect that if that sort of issue is raised, that the owner is going to take charge and deal with the problem. Now, some people, again, some owners, even some HR people, are better at dealing with this than others. Some companies take a more proactive approach to dealing with these problems than others, and that's, I think, where people often have a frustration is, they feel like if they've complained and they haven't been heard, then the system has not worked. But the system does work in many, many other situations, and I think people need to at least give it a try.
One of the other panelists Thursday night is Jacob Job. He teaches social justice at Park City High School. It's going to be interesting to hear what he has to say regarding how younger people view the power play between members of the opposite sex. Do you see any distinction between younger and older employees or business owners and how they view sexual harassment in the workplace?
You know, in my practice, I haven't seen much of a difference. I think that, you know, most people, regardless of their age, they want to come to work, they want to do their job, and they don't have to worry about, you know, having to put up with someone's inappropriate humor or having to put up with someone's inappropriate behavior. So I think that's a rather universal reaction in the workplace. You know, again, one thing we do notice, you know, with the younger generation is that a lot of the sexual harassment problems that we have to deal with tend to be more high-tech, right? So people texting inappropriate comments or exchanging inappropriate photos, you know, that's not exclusively limited to millennials or younger generations, but it has brought about a new and different element of the problem.
And is it only a harassment issue when opposite sexes are involved? Or, I mean, can there also be harassment issues between same-sex relationships?
Yes. So, the traditional complaint brought before the government authorities who deal with this has been, you know, the male harasser, the female victim. But that has changed over the years. And harassment is not limited to, you know, men telling bad jokes or men doing bad things in the workplace. And you're seeing more and more claims brought by men against other men, by women against other women, and by men against women in supervisory roles. More women are in supervisory roles, and you're seeing you know, them subjected to those sorts of complaints as well. So over the last 5 to 10 years, things have really changed in that direction.
Yeah, and really, I mean, the issue it has been happening forever. What's your take on the kind of the genesis of this Me Too movement? I mean, did it take Hollywood to break this out in the open?
I think what happened was that there were so many high-profile complaints at the same time that it was a moment when people realized, wow, this is a problem. Now, again, it's been a problem, like you said, for a long time. This has happened for the entire time I've been practicing law. We've had to deal with these issues. But you had so many high-profile people accused of so many really terrible and eye-opening offenses that I think it just became one of those, like I said earlier, teaching moments where people realized, okay, this is something we really should pay attention to.
Okay. And what is it that you'd like people to take away on Thursday?
Well, I think what people should take away on Thursday is that, you know, that there are tools in the workplace to deal with this problem. A lot of people don't complain because they're afraid they're going to be subject to retaliation, or they're going to be humiliated or mocked, or their complaint won't be kept confidential. And employers, in my view, have committed to try to create a place and a space where employees can raise these issues in a safe manner and where they'll be remedied. And I think people need to give that a try. Again, it won't work in every system because not every employer is going to be as proactive on this issue as they should be. But I think many, many employers are committed to trying to resolve this problem in their workplace.
Okay. Attorney Mike O'Brien, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
A reminder, the panel titled Sex, Power in the Workplace, Me Too, Movement or Moment will be held Thursday at St. Luke's Episcopal Church, 7 to 9 p.m. There'll be a 45-minute panel discussion, and the audience can follow up with questions after that. If you can't make it, we will be broadcasting the forum live here on KPCW. 8:23 now, good morning. Well, coming up May 24th, it's the Summit County Preparedness Fair, featuring a number of different agencies in the studio. Tell us what to expect. I have Public Information Officer Derek Sidaway and Summit County Fire Warden Bryce Boyer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Derek, we'll start with you. So what's happening May 24th?
So the Summit County Preparedness Fair is an opportunity for all members of the community across Summit County, Park City, North Summit, South Summit area to come and learn about our upcoming fire season, which Bryce will talk more about in a minute, and also to learn how they can prepare for any disasters that we may be affected by in Summit County, and also prepare for those by providing information about 72-hour kits. We'll also have a number of other programs and offerings there. The health department will be doing a drug take-back program. Valley Behavioral Health will be there, Red Cross, a lot of different agencies involved to kind of get a general overall health, well-being, and preparedness fair.
Okay, so it's Thursday the 24th. When and where?
It's Thursday, May 24th, as you said, from 5:30 to 8:30 at Treasure Mountain Junior High, 2530 Kearns Boulevard. And we'll be setting up, we'll have booths around the area, so you can come by, visit any of the locations that you are interested in to learn more. As I've already mentioned, we'll have information about disaster preparedness and readiness. One of the big things we're pushing is for people to sign up to the Summit County Alert System, which is the way that we're notifying residents or visitors that are in the county anytime anything is going on, whether it's a fire or snow conditions or whatever it might be. And you can check that out ahead of time at summitcountyalerts.com, but we'll have more information about that there. We'll also have stuff with the CERT team, Community or Emergency Response Teams, if you want to learn more about that and maybe get involved. Information about joining our volunteer radio programs and a lot of other things like that.
Volunteer radio programs? What's that?
So PC RADCOM is a new program that we're working to put together that connects neighborhoods throughout Summit County with handheld radios, basically licensed ham operators. There's been one operating in Camas for about 5 years, and we're looking to expand that program out into other areas of the county.
Cool. And I think this is, I haven't heard of a fair like this before. Is this the first one or just been a while since you've had one?
This is our second one kind of in this series. We had one last spring that was at the Richens building on a smaller scale. So this year we really look to expand not only what we were educating people about, but also the number of partners and agencies we were bringing in to involve the community.
Okay. So, Bryce, what's going to be your focus on at the fair?
So we're going to focus on the wildfire season. Right now it's really nice and wet and green. We've had a lot of rain. However, the outlooks are that through June, July, and August that it's going to significantly decrease rain. Temperatures are to be above normal. Experts and comparisons are being made to the 2012 wildland fire season, which for those that have been around for a while in the area, remember it was a pretty active fire season. So just trying to get the word out for people to start working on defensible space around their homes, be prepared to be more cautious with fires and so on. Probably expect to look at restrictions this year, even though we did not have them in the majority of the county last year.
What kind of restrictions are you talking about?
Right now, not sure. It'll kind of depend on how the season actually goes and pans out. But we could look at, you know, the restricted campfires, that kind of stuff. Also going to be working with elected officials and so on, keeping them up on what the outlooks are, what the fuel conditions are. And the state has, as most people are, I'm sure, aware, passed a new state fireworks law. So we'll be working with cities and county elected officials to make sure they're up on what those new laws mean, what they need to be doing, if they are going to look at doing any kind of fireworks restrictions. So based on the threat, the risk at that point, you know, that may be something that happens as well. Because 2012 was a very active, dry season.
Is this the one that we had up Rockport and came up to the top of the ridge there at Promontory?
That was in 13, but it was a continuation of the 12. There were a lot of fires throughout, closed I-15 down in southern Utah and so on. The other thing with going back to the fair is we'll have our wildland fire trailer up there, as well as brochures and so on fire adaptive vegetation that can be planted around structures and so on that's more resilient or retardant to fire spread and so on. So as people are starting to plant that and so on, those are available at the Utah State Forestry Fire and State Land website.
So the trailer that you've got, it's not one of those big mobile command things, is it?
No, it's just a small trailer that has wildfire safety info, brochures, kind of what to look for. And again, going over the defensible space, be prepared. Park City Fire and EMS will be at this as well. And I'm asking them to have some of their ready, set, go stuff so that people have an idea of what things to have ready in case they are evacuated, what to be planning ahead for as the season starts to approach. It's kind of difficult with just coming out of all the rain that we've had and as green as it is out there, but all that's doing is growing that now. The prominent vegetation will be the cheatgrass or June grass. Regardless of how much moisture it gets, it dies in June. That's why it's called June grass. So there's going to be a rather healthy crop of that this year, it's looking like, as well as not having had the snow. It hasn't packed it down, so it's all standing up, which it makes it more readily available to carry and spread fire.
Yeah. With that fireworks change, I think all it did was just reduce the number of days that fireworks can be shot off. I mean, it didn't give the county any more authority to ban them, did it?
It didn't necessarily give them more authority. It is a more, they have to specify the areas that are going to be closed and so on. Both cities and counties need to do that. So it's just working with them. Yes, it shrunk the time that they can be done, but it's also set that that has to be, if they are banning them, that they have to inform the public with mapping and all of that type of thing and notices as to what areas are closed, what areas are open, and go through that process.
Yeah, and then as we saw the devastation in Brian Head last summer, I'm guessing that what the guy did was illegal anyway, right? Using a blowtorch to knock his weeds down?
I'm not allowed to comment on that as it's an ongoing litigation where it's in court at this time. But it's one of those things where it's not illegal to burn your weeds and so on. You can go to summitcounty.org/firewarden, and we've got the information on incorporated areas, when and where you can burn, or what you need to do if you're burning it in an incorporated area, such as Park City. There's also information for those listeners and folks that are outside of the incorporated areas of the county, which would be over in the Silver Creek and that area, what the requirements to burn in those areas and what you need to do to be safe and be within the laws when you're burning in those areas. They are different.
Yeah. Has that time expired at this point to have an open time?
End of the month, so June 1. As of right now, it's open, and there's a link to the Division of Air Quality burn permit, which is required now, that they can do online, and then they need to make sure that they're notifying the county dispatch center prior to burning and when they're complete.
Okay. Anything else you guys want to mention?
We just want to encourage everyone again to come out to the Preparedness Fair. We'll have more information about the upcoming burn season and how you can prepare for that. And that's going to be Thursday, May 24th, 5:30 to 8:30 at Treasure Mountain Junior High.
All right, Derek Sitaway, Bryce Boyer, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:32. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, a Seattle, Washington firm has acquired the 96-unit Elk Meadows property located there along Kilby Road between Pinebrook and Kimball Junction. In the studio to tell us what that means for the future, I have the director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust, Scott Loomis. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as I was kind of reading through this press release, a regulatory agreement tied the original source of financing that actually restricted the property as affordable only through 2023. So what happens in 2023? It's a free-for-all?
Well, in some instances it is, but back in the day, in 1993 when this was built, they had a 30-year use restriction on it, which today the Utah Housing Corporation, which administers the low-income housing tax credits for the state, requires 60 years. And typically when you have the investor in these properties usually get out of them after 15 years, which is the compliance period. And then they have the regulatory use period as well. But after 15 years, they usually have what they call a right of first refusal, that generally, if you have a nonprofit involved, as a sale to the nonprofit, so in that case, it's preserved as long as the nonprofit owns it, which is usually in perpetuity.
So this didn't go to a nonprofit, though?
No, it didn't. The good news is the organization that is purchasing it is involved in affordable housing. They've got a tremendous reputation. I spoke to them before they made their bid and have spoken indirectly to their lender, KeyBank, through another source, and they work with this group all the time and say they're top-notch, and their intention is to keep it affordable after 2023.
Okay, because they had put that in their press release, but it was kind of just very vague in terms of wanting to provide the affordable housing for the long term. So
right. The owner of it, which was a private company, sold it 5 years early, I think, so the buyer could deal with it over that five-year period. They got five-year financing through Community Reinvestment Act funds that KeyBank had, so that obviously preserves it for the 5 years, and then afterwards, they'll probably work on restructuring a loan for a long term and hopefully be able to preserve it as affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Still, I noticed that a one-bedroom, one-bath unit online is going for almost $1,100 a month. It doesn't seem that affordable?
Well, they base the Utah Housing Corporation bases the rents, and they adjust them each year based on the area median income. And basically, people pay 30% of their income for rent and utilities, and they could actually get higher than that, I believe. These are targeted about 60% median income. And I haven't looked lately, but I think, as I recall, it's something like $1,350 targets income of 60% for a two-bedroom. So they're slightly under what could be charged.
Yeah, given that they're, you know, more than 20 years old at this point, I mean, they probably need some repair, no?
Yeah, they've been renovated a couple times. They've turned, after the 15-year compliance period, one of the largest affordable housing owners in the country, which is a subsidiary of Sun Insurance, owned it for a while. And I think they did a minor renovation at that point. But all these properties have reserves, so they are well-maintained and kept up.
Okay. So I guess you kind of hear about things like that. I mean, is that something that Mountainlands would ever consider purchasing to own? Or
it's a possibility. We don't have any right to do it. For example, we Holiday Village Apartments, which we purchased in through a low-income housing tax credits and several other sources of funding in 2000, they came out of the compliance period, and last year we were able to purchase 100% of it and refinance them and obtain them under our right of first refusal. We've done that with a couple of other apartment projects as well, and we've got a couple of them coming up online too. So even though they have this 15-year compliance period for low-income housing tax credits, the land use restrictions stay on them for a considerable amount of time. And some of the debt does as well, too. We've gotten like 40-year financing, 1% interest on some of the properties. So they'll stay in the affordable pool for a long time.
Yeah. And, I mean, are they a moneymaker or in the sense that you have make enough that you can fix them when they need to be fixed?
Oh, yeah. One of the things we have is substantial reserves for all of our properties. And, for example, at Holiday Village, the last 3 or 4 years we've been replacing the old shake roofs that have been there for 30-plus years. We're doing the last ones this year. We'll do the parking lot next year. So we have about $350 per unit per year. So that's $25,000, $30,000 a year, which goes into replacement of exterior as well as interior.
Yeah. So what was the situation, the housing situation this year? You know, I mean, we talked in the fall about how We needed people's help to open up their houses. Did that happen? I mean, everybody found a place, I guess.
You know, it happens every year. You wonder how they're going to, where everybody's going to go. And for some reason, people come in, there's nothing, and all of a sudden they find someplace. And oftentimes it's, you know, doubling up with friends or sleeping on, you know, several people sleeping on a couch or floor or something like that. But they come later and later every year with the visas, and they seem to shake out, and everybody finds a spot.
Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, how concerned do you get when you hear, you know, like we saw with the Prospector 1 building that the Park City Municipal purchased, where we had as many as 6 people living in a 400-square-foot studio?
Yeah, it's tough, and I've been doing this since 2001, and I've been seeing it. I remember going into some apartments when I first started that were now probably renovated and they're in the nightly rental pool, but they were pretty run down, and there were something like 13, 14 people living in a two-bedroom. And that was very common in the old days. I think the landlords are a little more selective and they stay on top of it, but it's one of those things that does happen because we have such a shortage of not only seasonal but year-round housing for people that work here.
So what else do you have going on? I know you're very involved with the Discovery Project. Is that, like, under construction?
No. as of yesterday, I had several conversations with the owners yesterday. They're trying to get their plat filed by May 18th, and they were going to have a groundbreaking ceremony this coming weekend, but there's an issue that arose at the last minute, and typically they're scrambling trying to get it taken care of, but they've got their construction loan ready to go. So hopefully in the next few weeks they'll be taking care of this issue and getting started on construction of the infrastructure, which means the vertical construction will probably happen near the end of the summer, beginning of the fall. So around that time, we'll start helping the owners get qualified purchasers for these units, and we'll actually have some housing. This project was approved in 2010, and here we are in 2018. We'll be lucky to have anybody living there, you know, 9 years later.
So. Yeah. And how many of those units are affordable?
There'll be 30 units altogether. I think the first phase is going to be 12 to 15 that'll be done this year, and then the rest of them will go as they develop the subdivision.
Yeah, and basically those are already spoken for, right?
We kind of jumped the gun last year. We thought they were closer to getting approvals and plat approval. So we have a number of people who a year ago qualified, and we will go back to them first, obviously, but there probably will be opportunities for people. You know, a year is a lot. People's income changes, their circumstances change.
Yeah. So what does somebody need to do if they're interested in actually having a shot at getting purchasing?
Well, the first thing is to get on the lists, which housinghelp.org, our website, you can get on the list for any properties. And we have also, we're hoping, going to knock on some wood if I can find it, that we might be able to get some townhomes started at Silver Creek Village with some apartments later this year. And so there'll be some opportunities for home ownership as well as additional rentals coming up.
All right. What else do you got working on?
We are under construction. In fact, we just drove by it yesterday on the third story of 38 units for a senior project that we're doing over in Heber with the Wasatch County Housing Authority, right next to the 23-unit Prestige Senior Center that we have right now. And then we've got another subdivision in Heber that we're hoping to get final approval on for 50 single-family residents and townhomes. It'll be for essential workers over in Wasatch County. They've got the same issues we have over here. They can't recruit and retain, and about 60% of their workforce actually commutes into the community every day. So they have issues, and they really are concerned about the essential workers and having them live in town. We've also got 8 units under construction under our self-help program in Francis in a new subdivision. You went to Willows, and we're going to close on 7 more here probably within the month and get started on those. So we've got a fair amount going on, and look forward to more in the next year or so.
Yeah, so in Wasatch County, do they also have a similar list like you have that you need to get your name onto?
The apartments over there have a year to 2 year waiting list. We own couple of apartment complexes, and actually one of them, Liberty Station, which is 54 tax credit units. They're nicer units. I heard they had a list of 1,000. So it's critical over there, too.
Okay. But who would somebody contact if they were an essential worker in Wasatch County?
Well, it's premature right now. We've got to put the infrastructure into the subdivision, so we'll get the word out. And we've had discussions with most of the the fire department, the police chief, all the different entities over there. So they know it's coming, and when we turn it on, we'll go through them.
All right. And then with the senior units, are those all for rent? Those are rental units?
Yeah. The first project we did was a tax credit project. It was 23 units, and basically that targeted incomes below 50% of the median income. And this project is going to target 50 to 80%. So it'll be a little bit higher rents, 1 and 2 bedrooms, 62 and above, it's going to be a nice little project.
Okay. Anything else, Scott, that you wanted to mention?
That's all. I think that, the good news is there's a little bit going on. The city's got some projects going, and I understand they closed on the lobster loft, they call it, last week, so people will be able to move into there pretty soon.
Great. Scott Loomis, Director of Mountainlands Community Housing Trust. Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
The Park City Council continues its budget discussions at this week's meeting. Thursday's meeting focusing on the 5-year capital improvement plan. In the studio, I have budget managers Nate Rockwood and Jed Briggs. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
Let's see, and I don't know if this who's can do this, but before we get into some of the specifics, can one of you give us a kind of a broad overview of the coming year budget? We know it's a 2-year no tax increase and includes a staff increase, pay increase.
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of broad overview since we're focusing on CIP today. So our budget process, you know, really begins with the council retreat in March, and that's part of our budgeting philosophy of budgeting for outcomes. So we really try to focus on council's critical top priorities, main objectives that they're trying to do throughout the year. During the next, you know, couple months, then we get our budget requests from managers, and we have a team-based kind of all these committees making recommendations to the city manager, and then the city manager's recommended budget is what we're talking about right now, and that was adopted by city council last week. And there's some operating increases that are, you know, focusing on some of our enterprise funds, transit and parking, some of those kind of initiatives that we've been trying to, you know, do at the city in terms of critical priorities and things like that. There is no health insurance increase, which was kind of a surprise and a big deal for us. I've never seen that before, so that's a little bit of good news. And then no property tax increase, like you mentioned. So, you know, the economy is doing well, and we try to take a very conservative approach to our revenue projections for next year, and that's really what helps us kind of guide the budget process.
Okay, so what are we working with? I mean, in terms of we've got an operating budget and then kind of the capital budget. Can you give us the amounts there?
Yeah, so, on the operating side, we're looking, when we focus on the general fund, we've had this philosophy of about 4.5% increase over the previous fiscal year, which is the fiscal year that we're in right now. And so that's something that we try to hold to, basically to kind of keep up with inflation and the cost of doing business. If you're looking at the entirety of the operating budget, it's a little higher. It's about 5.2% of an increase over last year. And a lot of that has to do with some of the things that I just mentioned, those transit increases and parking increases. Those are a little bit bigger than the 4.5%.
So what are we talking in terms of dollars?
On the operating side, it's an increase of about $3.6 million across the board.
Yeah, so the total amount is $84 million? I mean, what are we at? $74
million? If we're looking, yeah, it's about...
because it's over $100,000 when you add the capital fund in it as well.
Yeah, I mean, the capital amount goes up and down pretty dramatically over the course of, you know, the several years. So it just depends what we're funding over the next fiscal year. Nate, do you have that number on the total without capital, though?
Yeah, the total without capital is just over $73
million. Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. I think I heard that Park City's budget is like the third largest in the state after Salt Lake City and Provo. Maybe at the top five. I mean, you think that's kind of crazy, given that we have 8,000 people who live here full time. So talk just a little bit about that. I mean, is it a case that we need all of this expenditures, or is it just the fact that Park City receives so much in property taxes from second homeowners that we've got to spend it?
Well, it's a combination of a lot of things. There certainly is a large property tax base here. There's also a large sales tax base that is driven by the resort economy. Another thing when you look at it is that the city is running the municipal services. We're also running a full transit service. We have a full water district. We have redevelopment areas. And so there's a lot of different components that you might not have all in one in some of the other cities, but really, yeah, you know, very strong revenue base, and a very high level of quality services that we're delivering to the local residents, but also delivering to the resort economy to maintain that high level of service and guest experience that's coming.
So, Nate, that property sales tax, we're about half and half now, right? Which
yeah,
was not historically the case. It was property taxes kind of ruled.
Yeah, property tax was a little bit heavier. We've kind of always said over time the property tax doesn't have that inflationary component. On top of that, we've added several sales tax to do some infrastructure. And so when you start adding those new sales tax, it starts to be that we're a little sales tax heavy. Now, the truth is those sales tax, like the additional resort sales tax, the transient room tax, the transit tax that the county did, those are all going towards special services related to each one of those tax. And so when you look at the general fund, it really is balanced between sales tax and property tax the way that it has been in the past.
Yeah, so I saw a report a couple of weeks ago where it kind of showed 5 years into it, we run into deficit spending. I mean, basically what we're the trajectory that we're on with incomes, expenses will exceed that. So I've seen this before, though. It seems like it's always 5 years out. We would be in that 5 years, 5 years ago right now. So, I mean, what happens that we don't run into that situation?
Well, one of the things we do is on the operating side, even when revenues are growing, we're intentionally limiting the growth of that operating fund so that during the good times we don't hire more people than we need that we have to then lay off during a recession. Now, on top of that, we've continued to do things throughout the budget that help defer some of those costs. Several years ago, we put into place a stormwater plan of collecting some stormwater fees. That was just being paid for with the general fund. So things like that help. This last year, you know, we joined with the county in having some of the
With the dispatch,
yeah. Where we actually combined that dispatch and we got some savings there. So we're always constantly trying to find efficiencies and savings so that we push out that place where the revenues don't go over. And then the other thing that we do is that we're not being overly conservative with those revenues, but when we see sales tax growth in the 8 or 10%, we're not just saying, oh, we're going to see 8 and 10% growth ongoing forever. And so we put a more realistic number in there. Now, that said, we've had a very strong economy and have been very lucky. And so we have seen pretty significant growth. And so we're being very cautious so that we can balance the budget. But when we do see that growth, then we're able to sort of program those dollars towards the needs.
So what's important in this capital budget this year is that the council needs to find projects to cut in order to lower the bond amount for the Treasure Hill purchase. Right now, you've identified $7.5 million for the brew pub parking lot, and then another $1.5 million from
just some money that we had set aside from open space from the resort sales tax.
Okay, the 1%, yeah. And where did the other $1.5 million come? Because I thought it was a $6 million brew pub parking lot.
Well, so when we talk about the brew pub parking lot, then this is actually the Main Street Plaza. So there were several plazas that were planned where we were talking about the brew pub, talking about Miners, we were talking about the Coalition Plaza. So those are ones where we're saying the amount we had in there right now to kind of work on those was $8 million. That wouldn't have done all of those plazas anyways, but that's what was available. We're actually not taking all of that. We're saying there's some very minor improvements to the Miners park that need to be done. And we're also, you know, when you look at the brew pub, we really need to probably repave that and make that a little bit more presentable. So we're leaving some money in there to do that.
So are we going to sell the brew pub parking lot? I mean, is that the savings?
No, that's not the savings. The savings is just continuing to use it as a parking. When we've looked into, we actually went out and looked into selling that. When developers came in there, they were having the same experience we were having of it just costs so much to develop that site because of the way the soils are, because of the way that the floodplain goes through there, that they really weren't able to offer us a whole lot more where you feel like you're getting a meaningful value out of it that could help the treasure bond.
So what's the goal then in terms of, I mean, are there other opportunities besides the $9 million?
Yeah, so the $9 million is the ones that we're kind of saying, this is the starting place. We've identified these right now. We can do this right now and go out with a $55 million bond. A $55 million bond on the average primary resident would be about $220 a year. We also have an option in here of saying, okay, deferring and cutting some other projects to get that down to a $50 million bond. If you can get it down to a $50 million bond, that's about $200 a year. So you're saving about $20 per year. All of these are based on a 15-year bond, which is considered relatively short term for a long-term bond, but at the very smallest end.
So could we extend the bond and make it maybe more palatable or no?
You could. Mm-hmm. You could. What that does is that increases your interest rates, that decreases your bond rating. I think over time with the amount of debt that we issue for different projects, it would probably be more wise to keep it at a 15. In the end, it'll cost the taxpayers less.
So do you anticipate getting it below $50 million?
You know, that's one of the things during this council meeting is we're really going to talk about what does it get you, how much more palatable is that make the bond, and what are the trade-offs? I mean, the trade-offs there are we've had a long history of replacing the infrastructure, the street infrastructure in Old Town, which is, you know, needs to be replaced. When you talk about cutting it from $55 million to $50 million, you're basically saying we're going to delay that needed sort of core infrastructure for another 5 years to 7 years. When you talk about the sidewalks that are on Main Street that we've been doing in the plazas, that's really pushing those ones out even further where you're talking about, you know, those could be in the 10 to 15-year timeline. So it's really... What we're trying to do with the budget is trying to give as much information and frame the options in the best way that the council can look at it and say, we want to protect our core infrastructure. We want to protect the critical priorities of transportation, of housing, of, you know, net zero costs and those things, and balance that with the treasure, potential treasure purchase. And so we've kind of tried to lay this out in a way that they can evaluate those, stack them against each other, and make a recommendation that they think makes sense for the community. And so that's what we're really trying to do.
So have you identified other projects on the chopping block, potential ones?
Well,
without disturbing the core?
Well,
projects?
To an extent. I mean, the sidewalks on Main Street are one. The streets in Old Town are one, I mean, that is the core, but those are ones that you would definitely have to move.
I'm about out of time, but I guess I just think, you know, since we've got all of this money coming in, I mean, couldn't we do a better job of just kind of saving it so that when open space purchases come, we'd have like a down payment like anybody, you know, buying a house or buying a car would have?
I think one of the advantages of actually issuing bonds is that they're tax-free. The rates that we get on bonds are very, very minimal. And so when you actually go out and buy a bond, build whatever it is you're building, the people who are paying ongoing for that are the same people who are using the facility. So it actually makes sense for the users to be paying for it. And with the rates being as low as they are right now, it actually makes a lot of sense to take advantage of the bond market and get the infrastructure you need in place now as opposed to waiting.
Okay, but I'm just saying we couldn't do that with our streets and other needs, bond for those?
Well, the truth is that with the additional reserve sales tax, we are bonding for those. So most of what we're doing, we are issuing some sort of debt to do that.
Okay.
Whether it's water, streets, any of these facilities and open space. We've always done that through bonds.
Okay. Hey, Nate and Jen, thanks for your time this morning.